Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. We're turning our attention to climate and weather. Our weather guys, or at least our weather guy so far, is with us. Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So he's got a couple of different hats that he wears. These days, he's one of our guests. John Martin we're trying to reach him right now, and hopefully we will get through to him. But if we can't, then Steve, you're up for the next 45 minutes.
This'll be fun.
Well, you know what? Just to start, just to transition in. We were talking about all this research, and I don't think weather or climate research really came much into the forefront. So let's talk about that for a minute. What's going on in that area at UW?
So it's kind of exciting in that in the last 6 months to a year, we've been really looking at hiring more climate-type scientists. And so as one, and interdisciplinary as well. So one of the UW cluster hires that was approved, and a cluster hire is where you hire three faculty. They're going to sit in three different departments, and they're going to do work in those particular research areas, but they overlap. And so in one case of one of these cluster hires, it's about the changing Arctic. And so we're looking at a climate modeler to look at that, because we know the Arctic is changing a lot faster than other regions in the globe. I think we're also looking at a glaciologist to look at how the glaciers and the snowpack is changing. And I think they're also looking at a biologist to look at how the ecosystems are changing. So this is one of those research areas, I think, that we're really moving into with regard to, climate and how that climate is changing rapidly.
Yeah. Rapidly.
Rapidly. Well,
speaking of rapidly, I think Natalie Guyana, our producer, was able to get John Martin to join us as well. John, are you there?
I am, Larry. I'm sorry about the interruption there. That was I was taping a lecture, of all things. So, our new world has changed things. So that's what I was doing. So,
well, Steve and I are both happy to have you with us.
Here we are. Happy to be here. Thanks for getting me in.
We're in the midst of the severe weather season. Last week, some parts of the state had power outages due to storms and strong winds. And why is it that severe weather threats increase during spring and summer? John, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, in fact, that's what I was just talking about in my lecture. So it's right off the hot off the presses. So when you get to the spring and the summertime, there are a couple of different things that are changing rather dramatically. One of them is a little less obvious to most people, and that is that the jet stream starts to migrate a little bit more towards the north as the coldest air and the high latitudes loosens its grip and shrinks in its aerial extent. That drags the jet further north. Much of the late winter, the jet is well south of us, the average position of it, and as it starts to come northward, it drags with it the potential for some really substantial dynamics to drive the weather into some interesting manifestations. The other much more obvious thing is that the air itself gets warmer, and so does the water vapor content of the air. And so both of those things combined, the dynamics and juicier, more thermodynamically potent air, is the really the basic ingredients for an increase in severe weather.
Yeah. What about clouds? Somebody wondered about how do the clouds in the sky give us clues as to when a storm might hit?
Well,
there's certain clouds that are almost warning clouds.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think one of those warning clouds is what we call an arc cloud or a roll cloud, or a shelf cloud. That's often associated with a severe thunderstorm. And they look just like a shelf. I mean, they just kind of have a very flat bottom. Sometimes they look like a long roll of what you might see a paper towel rolled up around, that kind of thing. And, you know, I could try and verbally describe them, but I think probably the best way to describe them is when you look at them, you just know, oh, that's not good.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Oh. Is it the warm temperatures, this whole combination of things that brings on the tornadoes?
Yeah, it's related. You need to have a severe thunderstorm in order to really get a chance at a tornado. And one of the things that characterizes the severe thunderstorm is rotation. And at first, the rotation is oriented along, you know, horizontal axes, the kind that might be parallel to the ground. But if you then put in the updraft associated with a severe thunderstorm, with the thunderstorm cloud itself, you can distort those horizontally rotating tubes of air into ones that are more or less vertically oriented. And then you can sometimes see, talk about a warning sign, Steve will agree. If you ever see a rotating thunderstorm, you don't want to be anywhere near that thing, because that's likely going to be a potential breeding ground for a tornado. And sometimes the rotation is evident by eye. You don't need a time-lapse movie. You don't need any sort of tricks to see the rotation of a thunderstorm cloud. In fact, the arc cloud Steve's talking about sometimes is involved in that rotation, and you just can't miss it. And as he said, that's when you go to the basement. You just say, I don't want to see a sky that looks like that. It does not look friendly.
Bill from Green Bay emailed. He's got a question that's a little tricky to phrase quite right. He's wondering if you could measure all the ice, snow, steam, water vapor, water, lakes and oceans and so forth. Does that total amount ever change? The bottom line is, how does the total amount of moisture change?
Very slowly. So, you know, water vapor, as any molecule that's in the atmosphere, could eventually escape our atmosphere and get out into outer space. But that process is really slow, particularly for water, because most of it's trapped in the troposphere because of precipitation and cloud processes kind of keep it recirculating within the troposphere and not getting out into the stratosphere and then beyond.
Kenneth from Janesville called wanting to know a little bit more about the phrase that was just used, thermodynamically potent conditions. What is that exactly, and when does it happen?
Yeah, thermodynamics is a descriptive branch of physics that deals with one aspect of what it deals with is how fluid temperatures and various chemical constituents in a fluid will have an impact on the energy that's available. And so to bring it down to the atmosphere, warmer air and moister air, and the moistness is measured by invisible water vapor content, which we can measure. Those two characteristics of an AMS can really give that AMS a certain amount of energy in the development of clouds and therefore in the development of precipitation. So the warmer and the more moist the air is, the more potent it is for the development of clouds and precipitation. So that's what I meant by thermodynamically energetic or potent air masses.
Whole business of COVID-19 always seems to come up, you know, what else can we talk about sometimes? And somebody was wondering about whether or not the fewer cars, the fewer planes and everything has any effect in terms of weather or climate.
I think it certainly has an effect on air quality. We've seen that for sure. Just because, people are not getting in their cars and driving. Factories are not running, and so we're not burning as much carbon, fossil fuels. And part of that burning is aerosols and other gases that, you know, reduce the quality of the air we breathe. And we have instruments on satellites that monitor that globally. And we can certainly see, both in the U.S. and in China and in Europe, where the air quality has improved as things have been shut down because of COVID-19.
And we can talk some more about that. And, of course, take your weather climate questions as well at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@WPR.org. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests, our weather guys, they'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we will be back with our guests. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at climate and weather today with our two guests, our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve also directs Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at the UW. So, questions about weather or climate from them, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And with callers online, let's take a call or two here. Tom in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. Good to talk to you guys. And this is a question that kind of goes to all of you, and it's maybe a little off topic, but maybe more for the last segment. Has there been any discussion with the UW system as to whether or not they might inquire about taking over the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay? It's now shut down, and it could be a good source for graduate studies in astronomy or whatever, or client science.
Okay, Tom, thank you for calling. Steve, do you want to take that?
Not to my knowledge. I think that there has been discussions and issues in keeping the observatory on our campus up and running. Walshburn, Larry, what's the name of that telescope that's up on our campus?
Oh, the name, it's the Washburn Observatory.
Washburn Observatory, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of the telescope. It's a historically unique telescope as well as the other one. So I know so whenever I hear about keeping telescopes up and going, that's primarily the one that I've heard about.
There we go. Thank you, Tom, for calling. Ken in Monona, it's your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I got a question about wind. We're fortunate enough to live on Lake Monona, and it seems the last couple of years we've just had an awful lot more wind, big waves. And I'm wondering if anybody's got any record to say that there's been more wind recently in the last couple of years, or am I just imagining it?
Okay.
Well, Ken, I live on the north end of Lake Mendota, and if you're imagining it, I am too. It sure seems like a really windy year this year. And I need to go back to the state climatologist and ask them, how does this year compare to previous years? I haven't done that yet. it just seems like, particularly in April, early and mid-April, it was always windy. Again, it's anecdotal. It's what we remember. So we really need to go back and look at the data. And I haven't done that yet to really just determine, is it real or is it just my impression? But
yeah,
what do you think? The same thing.
What kinds of conditions result in wind?
I'm sorry, say that again, Larry.
What kinds of conditions result in wind?
The winds are a result of the differences in pressure across regions. So you have to have a parade of regions of low pressure cyclones and regions of high pressure anticyclones at a fairly high frequency and fairly decent intensity to have a maintenance of really intense winds or notably higher winds. I can just say, not having any property where the risk of erosion arises from waves, I haven't noticed that it's any windier than prior years. So I think that does lend a little bit to the sense of urgency that you might encounter if you live in such a place, a glorious place, of course. But as Steve points out, it isn't an impossible thing to go and actually check the records, and the wind will arise from a fairly steady progression of fairly intense cyclones and anticyclones, which hasn't really been the case on the very largest scale this spring, but it has been. We've had a few days that are exceptionally windy, and they may be the ones that kind of stand out in a person's mind as the scarier days in terms of property erosion. So that could be the case. I don't know what the records are either. No one seems to talk much about this question as one of the aspects of sensible weather changes that have been occurring over the last, 10, 15, 25 or 50 years. But it would be interesting to know what the answer actually is.
Might be a little bit of homework for one of your graduate students.
Yeah, it would be something that would be interesting to find out.
Ken, thanks again for calling. Tony in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Good morning.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Yeah, my wife studied weather trends for some time, and she also noticed when she went on walks during the day, there were a lot of chemtrails in the sky. And there's a lot of experts agree that we're managing the weather by spraying certain things into the atmosphere. She noticed that there were many weekends in a row where we'd have sun and then it would rain on Monday. Good example, today is raining, sunny all weekend, and there'd be three or four weekends in a row where it'd be sunny and then it'd be rain during the week. This cannot be just a coincidence. We're almost convinced they're managing the weather.
No. Well, are we able to manage the weather? Thanks, Tony.
No, we are not. Okay? There are no experts who think that this is the case. There are so-called experts who think this is the case. And I'll call your attention to this. I was commenting on this to my class just before we had the COVID break in lecturing. We had four or five straight weekends where the only nice days of the week were Saturday and Sunday. And so you're right. It isn't coincidence. It's just the natural progression of the way things go. It's lucky that we sometimes get a nice weekend. It's not always the case. But there's no evidence at all, and there's no way that it could even be done, that we could be controlling the weather while still making short and medium range forecast errors. It's absolutely impossible. They do not sit together in the same universe. So that's my strident anti-answer to that.
Okay.
And I'm going to just agree with him because I do agree with him.
Tony, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Arnie in Utica, Wisconsin. It's your turn. Hi, Arnie.
Yeah, hi. You guys, great show. Hey, I got a couple quick questions. First of all, I survived the tornado in August of 2005 here out in the Stoughton area. It was an E3. And my question is that about a half hour after it went past my place, there was still water coming down. I assumption it was from the moisture gathered on the way to Oregon and Stoughton. Two questions. Does the water stop tornadoes from getting bigger? And hurricanes, it's the other way, right? That's where water makes it better. And the last question, you guys, is the difference between a cyclone and a tornado. I'm just not sure. So I'll hang up, but I'd love to hear your comments.
Sure.
All right, John, you want to go ahead?
Okay, yeah. On the Stoughton tornado was quite a dramatic event. And I think I remember it, luckily for me, from a distance. But water will probably not have too much of an impact at all on a tornado because there's such a small-scale disturbance that no matter what they encounter, they'll be affected a little bit by what they encounter, but it won't really change them dramatically. And especially one of the smaller lakes around here is not going to have that big an impact on a tornado. So if one could replay it and guide the funnel instead of over the lake, over an open field at the same point in its life cycle, it's almost certainly the case that it would equally dissipate if it had gone over the field as it did in reality as it went out over the lake. So there's probably no impact. The impact on hurricanes of large bodies of water depends upon the surface temperature and the depth of the warm water in that giant body of water. So something like a lake, even a lake as big as Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans has no impact at all on a hurricane. And even one of the Great Lakes wouldn't have a very dramatic impact on a hurricane if they were to come across this latitude band. So it's giant bodies of extraordinarily warm ocean water that really have an impact on hurricanes, nothing on a smaller scale than that.
Interesting. Thanks. I was thinking about the Stoughton tornado when you were talking there, and I remember it occurred during my show.
Really? Wow, that must have been scary.
And there was a meteorologist who was visiting. He was from the Dakotas and was visiting a family in the McFarland area, Stone area, and called in right away and said, "I just saw it. It was an E3. So,
I bet he never got called back for a visit with that family ever again.
There he was. He had to come all the way to Wisconsin to see a tornado. Carl in Verona, it's your turn. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I'd like to get your guests' opinion on what they think the pace of global warming is going to be. You hear catastrophic predictions by people like Guy McPherson and Sam Carana, who say that we're going to warm 10 degrees Celsius in the next decade due to all the positive feedbacks and so on. But I'd like to get your guests' opinion on that. I know that the IPCC up until recently has been off. The things they predicted were going to happen at the end of the century are happening much, much sooner. And I don't know if it's because they didn't take into account the positive feedbacks or what, but what are your guests' opinion on the pace of global warming due to as many as 8 or 10 positive feedbacks that we're now beginning to experience?
John, do you want to start?
Okay. First, I would say that, I'm not one of the IPCC scientists, one of the thousands around the globe who are actually studying this problem as their main research interest. And I would certainly defer to them and their consensus opinion, because a consensus opinion among experts is always going to be conservative. It's not going to be aggressive in one way or the other. And I think that's actually that conservatism reflects our ignorance of some of the aspects, and appropriately reflects our ignorance of some of the aspects of the very feedbacks that you're talking about. Some of them, we know a couple of the gears and the mechanisms of how they'll work together. Many of the other ones, we have a lot of unknowns in how those gears mesh with each other and how the feedbacks would actually play out. And I think that's manifest in the somewhat conservative approach that the consensus takes. So my guess would be, because it's going to be aligned with what they're saying now, something on the order of a 2.5 degree Celsius temperature rise in the next 100 or so years, I think, is what some of the consensus opinions from the IPCC are saying now. So that doesn't sound as dramatic as some of the things that others are saying. And it certainly is not dismissive of the problem at all either. It's really taking it by the horns and saying we've got some work to do. But it's that's where I come down on it, because yeah. I will defer to the experts.
And Steve?
Yeah, I think the only thing I would add to what John is saying is that, as we read articles and search the web with regard to what's going on with climate change, there's extremes on both ends to the, claims that humans are not affecting it at all. It's just natural variability, which is not true, to the extremes on the other end, right, where we'll all be completely underwater all along the coastlines. Again, that's the other extreme. So I agree with John, looking at what the IPCC does, and they have a lot of information for the non-weather expert as well, explaining how they reach their conclusions and what those conclusions are and what the uncertainties are. And so I agree that that's probably the best source to go after.
All right.
Yeah.
Carol?
And I agree with Steve that's exactly right, that there are extremes on both ends. And the mainline experts are nowhere near either of those extremes, and they respect the fact that we can't possibly know everything. So
There you go, Carl. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Dave in La Crosse next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate what you three guys do with education here. I think there's a huge need for education on climate, global warming, basically, because people don't make the link between human activity generating greenhouse gases and warming. I think most people realize that things are warming up, but they don't get it why, and so they sort of deny that we have anything to do with it. And, you know, most of the education I've seen is directed either at little kids or at scientists. And there's a whole lot of us in between there that, you know, a lot of people have never had any chemistry or meteorology or anything else. And we need to get the word out to them, and I don't know how to do that.
Thank you very much, Dave, for calling. Well, his comments from both of you on this. John, you said, so I'll go to you first.
I think this is a great comment, and I very much agree with it. And I think Steve and I, both individually and as a pair, have done every opportunity we can. We do some sort of public outreach. And I don't think – I'm speaking a little bit for both of us, but hopefully I won't say anything that Steve disagrees with. But it's not because we think we're the only people who know anything about this, but it's because we have a great respect for the curiosity of the general public on these issues. And we do have a little bit of a catbird seat being in this field as professionals, and it's really wonderful to interact with people who have a genuine interest in the subject, especially when they don't come with any particularly strong bias about what they're ready to believe and instead are willing to listen to what the evidence seems to suggest, and well, first, what the evidence is as best as we can present it, and then what does it seem to suggest about the challenge that we face. And most people come to those kinds of forums or come to that kind of discussion with great, positive, well-intentioned attitudes. And it's wonderful to interact with them. So I very much appreciate the caller's comment, and we're doing what we can to do something about that, and I appreciate that he appreciates those efforts.
Yeah.
The only thing that I would add, I mean, I totally agree with what John said, and again, the importance of education in getting these messages out there. And that importance is also demonstrated in Larry's show, right? That's how one mechanism that we can have these discussions. And so, you know, kudos to Larry and Wisconsin Public Radio for having these types of call-in talk shows where we can discuss what the issues are and try to not just address people's questions and concerns, but also learn from their questions and concerns on our part.
And Dave, I would go back to the research side of things for a minute. I know my home department, which is life sciences communication, is doing a lot of research in the area of risk communication.
Yeah.
Which is really looking at that, what you were just talking about, Dave, and how to best communicate under all of the different kinds of ways that we have to communicate these days, how to help people and what we can do, what people can do as researchers and scientists to better communicate that information and give people sort of a way to get through the, fake news, for example, versus the real research that's going on. And I thank you very much for calling. There's a lot of research going on in that area and how to better be able to for everybody to be able to communicate that information to the public. That's one of the things that my home department is kind of a leader in the world right now, as a matter of fact, in what is called risk communication.
Yep.
So, can you give me the weather forecast for the next week or so, John?
Yeah, I think what we have right now is what we're going to have for the next couple of days through about Wednesday on and off. Tomorrow might be a little bit more convective, a little more thunder showery than today. And although we may still see some of that this afternoon, and then Wednesday will be a day of kind of maybe slight improvement. Thursday and Friday might actually be relatively warm. Now, oh, I wanted to point this out, too, that today, April 27th, is usually the it is the average day in Madison on which we have reached our first 80-degree Fahrenheit high temperature. We are nowhere near that in the near future,
really?
I can tell you that. Yes, April
27th,
isn't that weird? That's the average first 80. And the all-time latest is June 10th, 1997. So we could go a long time before we see 80 degrees Fahrenheit in the record book. But it doesn't look like in the next 2 weeks we have a chance of seeing such warm temperatures here. So, but maybe Thursday and Friday of this week will be more like Sunday was, like yesterday was, before another rainy period comes in on the weekend. So,
and it's going to be. Have we been in the 70s yet, John?
Yes, we had 170 something in. It was at an unusual time, early April. We had a day where it was like 72. I think I can't remember the date. You know, Scott Lindstrom knows right off the top of his head. I don't know what it is, but we had an early April 70 before we got a chilly second part of the month of April. Yeah. But we haven't seen 80 yet, and today would have been the average day on which we've already done that. So,
wow.
And that's in southern Wisconsin. It's a lot later in the northern part of the state.
Well, yeah, that's true, right, yeah.
What, July 30th or something? I don't know what it is.
It's much, much later. We had some great photos you guys couldn't see from of shelf clouds. Gert emailed some great pictures. And Gert was on the lake and shouldn't have been on the lake when that occurred, I think.
Yeah, put your
Gert,
lake
get off the lake
on the shelf.
Oh, that was bad.
Yeah.
On that happy note. Guys, thanks so much for being with us today. Steve, thanks for the whole 90. And John, thank you for joining us for the second half. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, I'm sorry about the first half, but thank you.
Oh, Steve, thanks. Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison. He is also a professor, along with John Martin, in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And they'll be back on Monday, June 29th, when by that time we'll have 80 degrees, I think. we'll shoot for that. Oh, man. In the meantime, thank you for listening. And by the way, stay with us. There's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network right through the afternoon and evening. I'm Larry Mueller.